So even if African Americans who were qualified got loans without discrimination, this enormous wealth gap would still perpetuate the segregation.
What's up? And welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
We're talking about an issue that essentially we all live and we see. And we talk about this today with some pretty extraordinary experts. Joining us from Emeryville, California, is Emmanuel Martinez. He's a data reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Hey, Emmanuel, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me on.
Good, good. And joining us from across the country, from Cape Cod, Massachusetts, is Richard Rothstein. He's a distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute, and he's author of the book, The Color of Law. Hey, Richard.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. So we're talking about an issue that all of us see in our cities and our towns, and we actually see it block by block. And I bet some people are saying, okay, what issue are they talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, homelessness, crime.
Yeah.
No, actually, we're talking about redlining. So I want to ask the both of you, like, for a visual of what this looks like, if you could just describe it.
Well, I've lived in many areas in the country over the course of my life, and every one of them has been residentially segregated, clearly defined areas where African Americans live, clearly defined areas where whites live. I took it for granted, as most people take it for granted, that that's the way the country is.
Yep.
We call it something like de facto segregation, a term I always used to use. And none of us realize, I didn't certainly, that this segregation was all explicitly created by government policy, designed to ensure that African Americans and whites couldn't live near one another. I grew up never knowing any African Americans, and this is true everywhere in the country.
Emmanuel, you're a little bit younger than Richard, I think. I don't know, because I haven't met you guys. But I think
he's old enough to be my grandson.
Okay, there you go. So, Emmanuel, like, very different life experience than Richard. Like, if you painted a picture for your own self, like, oh, that's what it looks like. Do you have one in your mind, like your memory?
Well, I think I only have to go back to when we were reporting the story in Philadelphia, where we went from neighborhood to neighborhood. And for the neighborhoods that weren't necessarily redlined historically or that are getting investment today, all these neighborhoods have storefronts, have people walking around. You know, they're more, quote unquote, family friendly to walk around. There are, you know, people sitting down enjoying their coffee at cafes, their yoga studios. And if you look at places that are redlined or aren't getting investment, you know, the streets have potholes. There are very few people walking around, very little investment. It's just not what you would consider a good place to be around.
Right. So basically, what we're talking about, you know, is the fact that people of color and white people have essentially lived separate from each other. And for people of color, it basically means that they don't, you know, people call them dangerous neighborhoods. No, they're abandoned. It means that you're living away, far away from jobs and services and where people stay away from your communities. You know, and housing segregation, right, it's not an accident. In 1934, actually, the federal government creates the so-called residential security maps. Oh, my God. These are for more than 200 cities. So here's a clip of Adam Conover from Adam Ruins Everything on True TV, and he explains it like this.
In the 1930s, as part of the New Deal, FDR created loan programs to help Americans finance their homes. But to decide who got those loans, the government created color-coded maps in which green neighborhoods were good and red neighborhoods were bad. This practice became known as redlining.
So the impact of what is now known as redlining in communities of color, I mean, it was huge, especially for the black community, because redlining made it more difficult for black people to get loans.
Right.
You know, it impacted the value of their homes. It impacted in terms of the decay of their neighborhoods. And essentially, if you don't own your a home and you're not able to own one, this is a way in which it effectively stops black people from accumulating wealth. And in theory, you guys, I don't know, because I was growing up around this time, in 1968, the Fair Housing Act passes.
Right.
You know, but basically, we're still living in places with tremendous segregation that we often don't see. Places like Baltimore, places like Ferguson, places in the Midwest, in Omaha. And I'm just wondering, Richard, in your book, The Color of Law, you show that it is actually not natural for this to happen. And now I want you to explain this term, the myth of the de facto segregation, which is just like, oh, segregation, it's always going to happen. That's the United States of America. And you're saying, not so fast.
Yes. The reason that our neighborhoods are segregated is partly because of redlining. That's the refusal of banks and other institutions to invest in neighborhoods that the government had defined as being high risk. But that's only one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is the exclusion of African Americans, particularly in the mid-20th century,
right,
from white neighborhoods in the suburbs that the government had created explicitly on a racial basis. The federal government subsidized builders to build the suburbs of this country. The most famous of these is Levittown, for example, east of New York City. Levitt the builder could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes in one place. He only got the capital to build that development because he went to the federal government, gave them a guarantee that he would never sell a home to an African American, agreed to the Federal Housing Administration's condition that he include a clause in the deed of every home prohibiting resale to African Americans. Once he did that, the government guaranteed his bank loans to create the development. And this happened in hundreds and hundreds of places across the country. The suburbs of every metropolitan area in the mid-20th century were created this way. So on the one hand, you have a government policy that effectively prohibits, because it will not insure loans to African Americans in redlined areas. But on the other hand, you have a complementary policy that prohibits white suburbs from selling homes to African Americans. These two sides of the coin is what created residential segregation. And we've adopted this myth. We call it de facto segregation, as though it all happened by accident. It happened because private prejudice or banks and real estate agents on their own just decided to discriminate against African Americans. Or we say maybe people just like to live with each other of the same race. Or
yeah.
We say, you know, we have all of these excuses. The reality is it was created by very explicit racial policy on the part of the federal government. And if it was created by government, it can be uncreated by government.
That's basically where I'm at in Boston. Like, I live in a suburb of Boston right outside the South Side, and it is clearly, like, white neighborhood, and then we border Boston, and that's the black neighborhood. And to hear Richard explain it is, like, it's exact, like you said, it's an example of everything that's happened all over the country, but, like, I'm living it, and you're still seeing this type of setup right now.
But you know what's weird, Julio, is, like, I'm thinking about my community, which is Harlem.
Yeah.
And something else is happening here that's different and sinister in a different way. And we'll get to that in a second, where, like, gentrification comes right up against redlining.
Exactly. And Emmanuel, you and your colleague Aaron Glantz at the Center for Investigative Reporting, you guys have been reporting on how redlining is still shaping cities and towns through banking discrimination. You guys built a massive database. And then you compared how banks treated loan applications according to race. And you guys also found stories of people of color that got inexplicitly, like, for no reason, they got denied from their loans.
Because I'm African American, I am way more likely to be turned down for a loan. And that's true in many places across America. We found dozens of metro areas where this is happening. In 61 cities, lenders were way more likely to deny conventional mortgage loans to people of color than whites, even after we accounted for how much a person made or how much they wanted to borrow.
That was Al Letson from the Reveal podcast of the Center for Investigative Reporting explaining what the team found. So, Emmanuel, tell us how far-reaching, right, modern-day redlining is in the United States. Is this housing racial discrimination common in rural towns or even in the most liberal cities? I think I already know the answer to this, but tell me what you found.
this isn't a problem exclusively located in one part of the country or one part of any particular city. This is a problem that affects the entire country. And in my analysis, you know, I went through 31 million mortgage records, you know, every time someone tried to buy a home, or almost every time someone tried to buy a home in 2015 and 2016, the most available data at the time we were looking at this, and out of 419 metros in the country, we found that 61 metros where people of color were more likely to be denied a conventional mortgage, even when they made the same amount of money, tried to take out a similar loan and live in a similar neighborhood, people of color were still more likely to be denied in those circumstances. And again, like, this affected places like in the South, in Little Rock, places in the Northeast, in Philadelphia, where we centered our reporting. In Iowa City, Latinos are almost four times as likely to be denied a conventional mortgage. And it's even here in California, in Vallejo, Chico, and Salinas, up into the Pacific Northwest, like Bellingham, Washington. The other thing is, we only focused on conventional lending, which is, you know, loans where the government isn't explicitly involved. There's the other type of FHA loans,
which are federal. So basically, for people that don't know, a conventional loan is sort of like your commercial bank, but there's FHA loans, which are, you're lending from the government, correct? That's the distinction.
Yeah. So whereas like the lender assumes the risk on the conventional loan, if the borrower defaults on the FHA, it's backed by the government. So this level of likelihood of being denied only focuses on conventional lending. So there's also, we didn't look at FHA lending, which also comes with its own set of problems. So that, all that to say is that, you know, 61 metros, it could be worse.
Yeah. it's so pessimistic. It's like, we came up with this, but this problem could be way worse.
And it's weird because we're talking about how basically this is really structural, right? It's not by chance. This is what structural racism looks like in many ways. And we know, right, how the federal government has, you know, promoted housing segregation. You've spoken also, Richard, about like private developers, Donald Trump in parentheses, community boards, you know, even unions promoting this kind of discrimination. So I'm wondering if you can explain, Richard, how segregation was promoted by more than just the federal government. And like, people used to believe that we were doing better on the issue of race. But the truth is that over the last four decades, it's been pretty shitty. And if you're a person of color and you're trying to own your own home, you know, I mean, I remember getting our mortgage applications. Every time we have to do that, it's just like terrifying. And we're the lucky ones who get approved. So what else happened besides just the federal government, Richard?
Well, state and local governments also participated in this. I mentioned before that most people think of real estate agents as being private actors who discriminated, and that's the reason that segregation happened without government participation. But every real estate agent in the country is licensed by a state licensing agency, and state licensing agencies throughout the mid-20th century explicitly required real estate agents to discriminate. Real estate agents could lose their licenses, their state licenses, if they sold a home to an African American in a white neighborhood.
Okay, wait.
What did he just say?
Wait, what?
What?
State licensing agencies would pull the licenses of real estate agents if they sold a home to an African American in a white neighborhood. So this was state action. This was not private
activity. Okay, Richard, but maybe we're getting that, like, we're like, okay, well, that was in the 1930s or 40s or 50s. And you're saying, yeah, no. 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s? No.
Well, let me explain how this affects today.
Yeah.
Even if I very much admire the research that Emmanuel and his colleagues have done at Reveal on redlining and mortgage discrimination, but even if every African-American family or Latino family who was qualified got a mortgage without discrimination, that wouldn't undo the damage that was done by these mid-20th century policies. I described before the suburbs that were created by the Federal Housing Administration on an exclusively white-only basis. Those homes sold to working class families in those days for, in today's dollars, about $100,000. Any working class family could have bought a home in Levittown or any of the hundreds and hundreds of other suburbs like this across the country. Mm. Black families could have bought them as well. They were prohibited by federal policy, required to continue to live in rented apartments in urban areas. Today, those homes that sold for $100,000 now sell for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 in these same suburbs. The white families who bought those homes in the mid-20th century gained over the next couple of generations hundreds of thousands of dollars in wealth. They used that wealth to send their children to college. They used it to take care of emergencies, medical or temporary unemployment. And they used it to bequeath wealth to their children who have down payments for their homes. African-Americans were prohibited from gaining that wealth. Most wealth in this country that middle-class families have comes from the equity in their homes. Today, nationwide, African-American incomes are about 60%, 60% of white incomes. African-American wealth is only 10% of white wealth. Wow. And that enormous disparity is entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy that was practiced in the mid-20th century. So even if African-Americans who were qualified got loans without discrimination, this enormous wealth gap would still perpetuate the segregation that we have in this country today.
Welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa. I'm with my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. We're joined by Emmanuel Martinez and Richard Rothstein, and we're going to get right back to our conversation. So this kind of reminds me of what happened a year and a half ago in Charlottesville, where you're at this, you know, the white supremacist rally, and they shouted, "You will not replace us." And I'm like, you don't understand. You know, we're actually being locked out of the possibility of being your neighbors. And I mean, this is just one example, right, Julio?
Yeah. It's like this fear, like there is no fear.
Exactly.
Because basically everything's structurally set up for the fact that, you know, neighborhoods and communities will never integrate because there's this structural issue that people of color cannot get loans to get housing. And they're so far behind in the wealth. It's what Richard was saying. It makes complete sense to me when you start thinking about the benefits of home ownership in the United States and how it leads to wealth and leads to better opportunities. And people of color are still stuck. They're still stuck, Maria. And then, you know, to add to all this, we need to start discussing the connection between segregation, redlining, because it's definitely not a thing of the past, like Richard explained and Manuela are talking about. But then you add the layer of what we, you know, the G word, gentrification in all this. A lot of people think it's the hip new coffee shop, right, in the neighborhood. The local bodega closes down, and then people of color just get evicted and they because they can't afford these rent prices. Because, you know, basically, if you really start stripping it down and looking at this in context, as a consequence of all this, gentrification is essentially a shift in the population in a particular area. Basically, the increasing of housing costs that push out low-income residents. And all this is happening while the United States is still in the midst of a housing crisis, right? Which is affecting working-class people and POC communities. There was a report in 2017, according to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, that only 12 counties in the whole country have affordable rent for low-income residents. So you're just kind of pushing the problem. So I want to know more about this link between the legacy of segregation and gentrification and the current housing crisis. So, Emmanuel, like, how does gentrification play into modern day redlining?
The one law that we were talking about in the beginning was the Fair Housing Act, right? That was supposed to ban overt and explicit denials of mortgages based on race. 8, 9, 10 years later, there was another federal law called the Community Reinvestment Act, and that required lenders to make an effort to lend to all types of communities, particularly low and moderate income neighborhoods, i.e. poor and working class neighborhoods. And it's built that way with a focus on the income of the neighborhood and not necessarily on the race of the borrower. More so, it's income driven, right? And that will come to play now with gentrification, because that means what Aaron and I have been reporting on, particularly in Philadelphia, is that banks can claim federal credit by lending in these poor and working class neighborhoods, but making those loans to white gentrifiers. So you can have these neighborhoods that, you know, have received no investment, where there are primarily, you know, POC neighborhoods, mm-hmm. that are primarily Latino and Black neighborhoods. But those neighborhoods can see investment, but not necessarily to those residents. We focused on a neighborhood in Philadelphia called Point Breeze, and it's 80% Black. And a lot of residents there are upset because it's being gentrified, and partly because a lot of those 80% of those loans are going to white people moving in. And so this is how lenders, mortgages have kind of fueled gentrification, in the sense that you don't necessarily need to lend to the people who live there because the federal law is race neutral, but you can lend to white borrowers, thus changing the neighborhood, displacing those residents that once lived there.
So, Richard, from your perspective, what's the relationship between this segregation and the gentrification that we see now?
Well, you know, we can't have it both ways. If we want to create integrated neighborhoods in metropolitan areas throughout this country, gentrification is going to be part of it. We cannot say, on the one hand, we want to end segregation and end redlining, on the other hand, say we're going to preserve neighborhoods as exclusively low-income places where no middle-class families can live. What we need to do is, where we have a neighborhood that's gentrified, we need to preserve a share of housing in that neighborhood for the residents who have traditionally lived there, typically African-Americans, Latinos in most places. And we can do that with a variety of policies. We're not doing it now, but we can do that with a variety of policies,
It's not that hard.
Rent control.
I mean, you're in a neighborhood right now, Maria, right? Is it that hard?
So, Richard, just so you get a sense, for example, like in my neighborhood of West Harlem, you know, it used to be that our local park was the park that it was so dangerous you couldn't even step foot into it. And nowadays, it's the local park of, you know, the $10,000 dogs. And be careful if you're run over by the Columbia University wrestling team that's running up and down the park. By the way, I'm a Columbia grad, like, love them.
Right.
But I have this thing. There's this thing that we call in Mexican Spanish, que te da pena ajena, where you feel shame for people from afar. Like, you're like, oh, my God, you've got like a big splotch of ketchup on your mouth. I'm ashamed for you. Like, you should clean it up, that kind of thing. And I look at my new neighbors who are gentrifying. We've been in the community for 20 years, but I look at the neighbors, and it's like they have these floor-to-ceiling glass, open-air living rooms and kitchens, you know, with $30,000 kitchens. And I'm just like, guys, like, close up your windows, you know, like, have a sense of – have a little bit of sense of the place.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, you know, around this question of gentrification, segregation, you know, kind of pushing up against each other, you know, what do you say to white folks who are, you know, who are in these communities? I mean, there are things that can be done. As you said, look, rent control, you know, separating off a segment of the housing stock to keep people in their community. But on a people basis, like, you got any recommendations?
Well, clearly, we want to create integrated communities where people are sensitive to each other, where they appreciate each other's backgrounds and cultures and interact with each other. One of the things that we can do is encourage people to put their children in public schools, not send them off to private schools. That would be one thing that would help. But if we preserved a share of housing in those communities for the previous residents, whether, as you say, with rent control or limits on condominium conversions or freezes on property taxes for people who've lived there, even if we did that and created a truly integrated community that had both moderate and low-income housing and even some affluent housing in it, it would still be the case that some people would be displaced. You can't have it both ways, as I say. You can't have both an influx of middle-class families, or even in some cases upper-middle-class families, displacing some families and preserve the housing for others without some people being displaced. And the big problem is that nobody is paying attention to where these people are being displaced to.
Right.
Because they are excluded from most of the other communities in the metropolitan area, they wind up being displaced to new, segregated, usually inner-ring suburbs
right.
that just move the problem from one place to another. every neighborhood should be gentrified. Every neighborhood in every metropolitan area should have a mix of moderate, low income, and higher income housing.
Did you hear that? Okay, I just want to. Okay,
I'm sure our listeners are going to be like,
wait.
There's
what?
A logic to that. I think in terms of the idealness of what Richard is saying, and in the end, it's the only way to fight through something that's been structurally grounded, right? Mm-hmm.
You know, seeing what's been happening in Harlem and West Harlem. It's a community that, you know, 25 years ago didn't have a bank, a pharmacy, dry cleaners. We had a lot of, you know, takeout Chinese. We had a lot of liquor stores, bodegas, yes. So in one sense, what Richard is saying when he's saying every neighborhood should be gentrified, he's saying every neighborhood should have access to every single offering that any other neighborhood has. But I'm wondering how you're reacting to what Richard just said.
Well, just based on what you described, that's what I've seen. Like, I kind of started with the data in terms of looking at neighborhoods that are getting investment versus those that weren't getting investment. So I had this map, you know, the brighter the color, the more investment, the lower shade the color, the less investment. And I had that map for Philadelphia. And then we went to Philadelphia and I pulled up my map and I was like, I want to go here where it's highlighted really dark red, meaning it's getting investment. Mm-hmm. And like I said, you have all these cafes, you have families walking around with their children. You know, it's quote unquote family safe. You have nice paved streets, you have bank branches. You have pharmacies, you have all these access to resources. And then I went to a neighborhood that wasn't getting investment. And what did it look like? You know, streets full of potholes, boarded up homes. There were no bank branches. That's the other thing that I kind of think about when I think about this reporting in terms of, you know, the argument why people of color get less mortgages, less investment is that, you know, people of color don't trust banks. Well, you can't trust something that's not there. And in Philadelphia, wow, there are very few bank branches in neighborhoods of color. And when you look at post-recession, I have this story. The bank that my parents, you know, constantly went to in Fresno, mm-hmm, it was like a 10-minute drive. And post-recession, it started closing down. And so this is a city that's primarily Latino. It lost its bank branch. And I heard this story like several times in Fresno that, you know, in these Latino neighborhoods in Fresno, bank branches were shutting down. So how can you then get a mortgage if you can't walk into your bank branch, if you don't have that resource to, you know, go get a mortgage? So when we talk about housing and segregation, it often, from all the experts that I talk to, it usually starts with housing and then it trickles down to schools and then it trickles down to resources.
Right, right.
All right. So we cannot end our discussion about the issue of housing.
Right.
Without talking about a president by the name of Trump, mm-hmm, and how his administration plays into this, you know, and of course, the history of the Trump family and their very active role in denying Black folks a place to live, which has been documented. So right now, under this president, we have a secretary of housing who's a doctor. His name is Ben Carson. It's a little weird. And Ben Carson, you know, this brain surgeon, has been working to change fair housing rules that were established under Obama. We've also got a secretary of the Treasury that people, you guys, they used to call him the foreclosure king, Steve Mnuchin.
Yep.
And we know that Trump himself, of course, was caught up in the housing discrimination in the real estate business in the 70s. And that's a case that was settled, actually. And as a part of this, Trump and his father had to promise to not discriminate in their... Oh, my God. They're so trustworthy. They had to promise not to discriminate in their real estate projects. Okay, I know.
After those promises, Trump is president, right? And Emmanuel talked about the federal law, the Community Reinvestment Act, which the Trump administration basically wants to overhaul. And like this act, it regulates how banks lend to poor and working class neighborhoods. So obviously, housing advocates, no surprise, they're saying that these changes are going to make it way more difficult for low income families to get housing loans. So how is the Trump administration impacting the makeups of our cities and towns? How has redlining and housing segregation evolved over the past 2 years? Richard, what are your thoughts?
You may be surprised, but I'm not so focused on it. In any social policy,
Yeah.
It's always easier to focus on the things that change rather than the things that remain the same, even though the things that remain the same may be much more powerful than the few things that are changing.
Whoa. Okay.
That was like some deep knowledge. I like this.
Okay.
Continue, Richard.
We got that. We're going to put that up in block letters here.
So the Trump administration certainly has made things marginally worse, but the underlying reality was worse to begin with. We've had Democratic administrations before, and they haven't solved this problem. What we need is a massive re-education of the American public about the government's responsibility for creating these problems, and only then will we be able to pursue the kinds of policies that are necessary to reverse it. Wow. We wouldn't be having this discussion about redlining, about government imposition of segregation, if it was only the Trump administration that was causing the problems. They are making it marginally worse. Let me just say, Carson, whom you mentioned.
Yes, sir.
He calls policies to reverse segregation, he calls them social engineering. And many people understand that and agree with that. They don't understand. What Ben Carson doesn't understand is that this is not social engineering. This is an attempt to undo social engineering. The entire segregation of this country was socially engineered by the government. And until we understand that, we're not going to be able to undertake the kinds of policies to reverse it, whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration or even an extreme administration like the Trump one.
So let's move on to our final segment called Sin Pendejadas, or basically, no bullshit.
So we can talk about how the government impacts housing segregation, but, you know, like at the end of the day, it's really a lot about everyday decisions. We can either perpetuate or we can prevent this kind of segregation in big ways and in small ways, right? And local communities have resisted efforts to desegregate their cities. One of these cases, actually in Yonkers, that I reported about during the 1980s and 90s, I was reporting about it during the 90s, there were people in Yonkers that were just resisting desegregation, which basically means they were enjoying being racist and separatists. This became a part of an HBO miniseries called Show Me a Hero.
The city intentionally segregated its housing for 40 years.
The whole damn city government's white.
This judge wants to take low-income housing and put it here in East Yonkers.
And in the series, Oscar Isaac, the fabulous Guatemalan actor, plays the mayor of Yonkers, who is forced by the Department of Justice to build public housing in middle-class areas of Yonkers. And essentially what happens is, like, the mayor is pitted against the overwhelmingly white population that will they resist having public housing built near them. So the question is, how are regular citizens contributing in a bad way to the segregation? And can regular citizens do anything to do the opposite and instead prevent segregation and promote fair and equal housing? So let's start with you, Richard. You know, what is some things that people can do?
Well, you know, I talked about Levittown before in the mid-20th century. There was a group of people in Levittown at that time. They called themselves the Committee to End Segregation in Levittown. We've always had opposition to these policies, and we can reinvigorate that kind of opposition today and take small steps to try to reverse it. Clearly, it can't be reversed without government policy, because the economic differences, the structural differences that we've been talking about, are far bigger than any one individual can change. But individuals can do something. I was in Toledo the other day, and in Toledo there's an organization that's beginning a campaign called WIMBY, Welcome in My Backyard.
Oh, that's instead of NIMBY, which is not in my backyard.
Yeah, instead of NIMBYs, yes.
What are they doing? Yeah.
They're putting up lawn signs. They're getting people to sign pledges that if their house comes up for sale, they'll list it with a real estate agent who proactively tries to promote integration. They're signing pledges about their own behavior and how they're going to be welcoming to people of diverse backgrounds who live in their neighborhoods. It's a small thing. It's not going to be as powerful as government policy, but it's a way of beginning the kind of local activism that you're describing. Clearly, government can't do it without local activism. It's people who are going to force the government to do it. And we need a new civil rights movement, really, to finish the undone work of the civil rights movement of the mid-20th century, which never addressed residential segregation because it had this myth that it happened by accident. You know, we dealt with school segregation, we dealt with water fountain segregation, we dealt with lunch counter segregation. We never dealt with residential segregation. It's the unfinished business of the civil rights movement, and it's not going to be finished unless there's a new civil rights movement that becomes active and aggressive and as insistent on desegregating this country as it was about desegregating other institutions in the 20th century.
And Emmanuel?
We put together all this data and, you know, by lender and how well or how poor they lend to people of color. So I would tell people, you know, if you want to make a difference, you should focus on lenders, buy a mortgage or, you know, bank with banks that have a good track record of lending to people of color. That's, I think, one of the easiest ways to do this, to be conscious of this, that, you know, banks often, lenders perpetuate these things. We reported on one called Trident Mortgage Company, and they in Philadelphia, where it's, you know, half black, half white almost, they're mostly focusing their lending on, you know, white people because that's who they serve. So I would be conscious if I were getting a mortgage, I'd be conscious, you know, who am I dealing with? What's their track record of lending to people of color, and just choose a lender based on that criteria.
Richard Rothstein is a researcher and author of the book, The Color of Law. Emmanuel Martinez is a data reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. And thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this super important conversation on In the Thick.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Hey, and before you go, this Friday, In the Thick has two back-to-back live shows in Mission, Texas.
Hell yeah! I'm so excited. And, you know, we want your voices to be part of the live show in the Borderland. So what questions do you have about Texas politics and Borderland life and culture? And if you're from the Borderland, call us too and tell us what the rest of the country is completely misunderstanding about the place that you call home.
That's right. Call us at our listener hotline. That's like ding, 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 ding. The In the Thick listener hotline at 505-226-8973.
Right. The number again is 505-226-8973.
And, you know, the other thing that you can do is to take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to us, because it really helps other listeners to find us. And, you know, they can find us on Pandora, on Spotify, and wherever podcasts exist in the world. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell everyone you know to listen. In the Thick is produced by Juan Pablo Garnham and Nicole Rothwell. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. We will see you on our next episode of In the Thick. Thank you, my dear listener. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
Nos vemos.
Ciao.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.